Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 74. It's Saturday, August 8th. I am coming to you from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Welcome to the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And amidst this ongoing coronavirus pandemic, may public health become contagious. Okay, let's start with the bad news, good news department. Governor DeWine first test positive, then negative with a more accurate test, exemplifying the reality of false positives. Of course, I have been reporting on Governor DeWine's false positivity for months now. Also in bad news, good news, the bad news, San Quentin overtakes Ohio's Marion County Correctional Facility for the largest single COVID-19 outbreak ever in the U.S. The good news, we're number two. And in other prison news, this from CNN. Inside the federal prison where 3 out of every 4 inmates have tested positive for coronavirus. Since the beginning of May, when there was only a single coronavirus case at Segalville, the number of inmates who have tested positive has soared to 1,333, according to Bureau of Prison data, including prisoners at a minimum security camp next to the prison. 28 of the roughly 300 prison employees have also tested positive. The outbreak means that this Texas facility has more coronavirus cases than about 85% of the counties in the United States. Dr. Homer Venters, the former chief medical officer for New York City's jail system, who has inspected federal prisons' coronavirus response plans, said outbreaks at Segalville and other prisons were like, quote, popcorn kernels popping off over an extended period of time. There are many facilities that either have gone through the same thing or will, he predicted. This is a really tragic situation that's playing out all over the country. Segalville Prison near Dallas has suffered the largest coronavirus outbreak of any federal prison in the United States, with more than 1,300 inmates testing positive. Nationally, more than 10,000 federal inmates and 1,300 Bureau of Prison employees have tested positive for coronavirus, while 111 inmates and one staffer have died. Several other federal prisons have also faced dramatic outbreaks, although none that infected as many inmates at Segalville's. In Ohio, a judge ordered officials to release or transfer more than 800 vulnerable inmates at another federal prison ravaged by the virus, saying the conditions in the facility had possibly reached the level of, quote, cruel and unusual punishment. But an appeals court struck down that order in June, finding that inmates did not prove the Bureau of Prisons was, quote, deliberately indifferent to the risk presented by COVID-19. Okay, well, let's get to local news. Good news for a change. The skyrocketing cases in Lucas County have shown a drop. The 7-day average of new COVID-19 infections has dropped by about 25% over the last week. Active cases in nursing homes have held steady, perhaps the best we could expect with much higher levels of infection in the community as a whole. Still, Lucas County, relative to Ohio's other 6 metropolitan areas, is by far the worst off. While testing numbers are actually going down in Ohio, The percent testing positive is also going down. Overall in Ohio, identified infections have gone down by about 25%, though they are still almost three times higher than Ohio's June low. The trend is good, though something to keep an eye on, cell phone data on encounter density over the last week showed a big jump in Ohio, with a parallel but smaller jump in Lucas County. On a worrisome note, this is a pattern that is similar to other regions around the country, where spikes have moderated. Apparently, people respond to relative changes in the epidemic, even though absolute levels of infection continue to be very high. With cases remaining very high, testing remains an ongoing challenge. In some good news from Ohio, this from The Hill. Six states band together to secure rapid COVID testing. Bipartisan governors of six states have entered into a first-of-its-kind agreement to jointly purchase rapid coronavirus testing kits. The governors from Virginia, Louisiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, Ohio, and Maryland said the goal of the compact is to show private companies that there is significant demand to scale the production of these tests, which deliver results in 15 to 20 minutes. The states will also coordinate on policies and protocols regarding the testing technology. Additional states, cities, and local governments may join the compact in the coming days and weeks, the governor said. The states are in discussion with Becton-Dickinson and Quidel, the U.S. manufacturers of antigen tests that have already been authorized by the Food and Drug Administration, to purchase 500,000 tests per state for a total of 3 million tests. Okay, I'm going to stop here for a little bit of editorial comment. One of my really annoying pet peeves in trying to report on this is that reporters throw out huge numbers all the time without providing any context. So I did a little research and to provide some context. So this 500,000 tests, which sounds like a lot and is quite a bit, this represents about 1 month of the total testing that's done in Ohio. So if you were to use all those tests within a month, that would say double the amount of testing that we're currently doing in Ohio. Of course, we don't know when or over what period of time these tests are going to come. But good news nonetheless. Okay, back to the news story. 5 months into the pandemic, the Trump administration has yet to develop an efficient testing system. In the absence of a national testing strategy, states have been left to come up with their own plans and secure their own equipment. Across the country, the demand for tests has outstripped supplies, creating severe shortages and delaying results for unacceptably long periods of time. The agreement would reduce the need for states to rely on overburdened commercial labs. For example, Quest Diagnostics said this week that the average turnaround time for a result is 5 days. It's an improvement over last month when it said average results would take more than a week, but still creates a potentially dangerous waiting period. Rapid antigen testing may not be the most accurate, but it can be used to help detect outbreaks more quickly and expand long-term testing in congregate settings such as schools, workplaces, and nursing homes. And in a related story on testing, this from The Hill, U.S. urged to consider cheaper, faster COVID-19 tests to contain outbreaks. 7 months into the pandemic, the U.S. needs to rethink its approach to testing for COVID-19, experts say, by shifting to cheaper tests that can return results in less than an hour, potentially finding people when they are most infectious and containing outbreaks before they explode. The Food and Drug Administration, however, appears reluctant to approve those tests for sale in the U.S. because they are typically less likely to detect small amounts of virus compared to the gold standard, high-sensitivity lab tests the U.S. has been relying on. As demand for tests surge, those lab tests have taken longer and longer to return results, making it extremely difficult to contain outbreaks. The rapid tests, some of which can be used at home, aren't the gold standard and can miss infections, but experts say they make up for it through their speed and low cost. Because they're cheaper, they can be made available to millions of people to use several times a month, experts say. Additionally, the tests are actually very good at detecting virus when it matters most, at high or peak levels, when an individual is most contagious to others, experts say. If you want to be certain about whether somebody is infected or not, these tests are not so great. if you want to identify whether they're infectious or not going to go out and spread to other people, these tests are actually quite good, said Ashish Jha, a physician and director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. The United States ran about 5 million tests the last week of July, significant improvement from the early days of the pandemic when tests were hard to come by. Commercial labs now run about half of the COVID-19 tests across the country, but turnaround times have grown longer as demand surges for testing in states in the South and West, where outbreaks are leading to thousands of new COVID-19 cases per day. Demand for tests is expected to grow in the fall when students return to school and the flu season hits. Experts say rapid tests will allow individuals to regularly screen themselves for COVID-19 before they go to work, school, or other areas where they could potentially spread the virus to others. Harvard's Michael Minna envisions a $1 antigen paper strip test, similar to pregnancy tests, that could be manufactured by the government and distributed to millions of people to regularly screen themselves. Several companies are working on similar tests now, but have been slow to ask for FDA approval because it doesn't meet the agency's standard for high sensitivity. Our goal is to make an at-home test, but because of FDA criteria, we believe there's a longer path to get there, said Carlos Andre Ferre, spokesman for E25 Bio Inc., a company that has its roots in developing rapid tests for mosquito-borne illnesses. Within the next few weeks, E25 Bio plans to ask the FDA to approve a rapid antigen test that will initially only be available in clinical settings because that is what the FDA will approve. But eventually, the company hopes to have a home-based test that could be easily used and accessible to anyone. I think FDA is not quite there yet. I think that they could come around to it, but I think there will be a lot of steps required to get to a place where we can have an at-home antigen test, Ferry said. While the at-home rapid tests are less sensitive than the lab tests, Ferry said they could be of critical help to the United States. A test like ours is very effective in detecting high viral loads, meaning people like super spreaders, Ferry said. We think that this is a very effective screening tool to separate infective individuals who have the highest chance of spreading virus and continuing the outbreak versus people who don't. Experts say rapid antigen tests should ideally be used multiple times a week, especially for essential workers and others who have a higher risk for exposure. A negative result doesn't necessarily mean someone doesn't have COVID-19. It could also mean they have a lower level of the virus that the test can't detect yet. We have to stop thinking about this as somebody gets a negative test and they get a clean bill of health. They can do whatever they want, Jha said. That's not what the point of these tests are. The point of these tests is we're doing them frequently. You're getting results frequently. And if you tell somebody who has a negative test, you're not infectious today, but you could be infectious tomorrow, you still need to wear a mask, you still need to do social distancing, and we're going to retest you in 3 days. If we have that strategy for high-risk people, we really can make a big difference. Only 1 of 10 COVID-19 infections are being detected through testing, according to a recent CDC estimate. That is partly because a high percentage of infections, up to 45%, are thought to be asymptomatic, meaning they harbor the virus and can transfer it to others but won't experience symptoms themselves. Regular screening using rapid tests will do a better job of finding people who have COVID-19 but aren't showing symptoms, experts say. Without regular screening, an asymptomatic person might not even have reason to get a test and could potentially spread it to more vulnerable people who could experience serious illness or even die. A study led by Daniel Larimore at the University of Colorado and several other colleagues modeled the benefits of frequent testing in a paper that is not yet peer-reviewed and found frequency and speed of testing outweighs high sensitivity. The purpose of a screening test is to identify as many infections as possible, as quickly as possible, Larimore said. If moving to a less sensitive test means we can do 10 times as many tests, from the screening point of view, that's a great trade-off to make, because you'll catch more infections than if you tested fewer people using a higher sensitivity lab test, he said. The key thing rapid turnaround tests do is they give you highly sensitive results around the time you're most infectious to others. The FDA has approved 2 point-of-care tests by Quidel Corporation and BD that detects COVID-19 antigens. These tests can return results in 15 minutes and have a higher sensitivity than paper strip antigen tests, but are more expensive and are not intended for home use. The tests require machines, most of which are in nursing homes and doctor's offices. Governors of six states announced that they would band together to buy 300 million rapid antigen tests to be used with BD and Quidel machines to better detect outbreaks more quickly and expand long-term testing in congregate settings such as schools, workplaces, and nursing homes. The tests are about as accurate as the gold standard lab tests, but still aren't widely available or accessible to the general public. As far as paper antigen tests go, the Trump administration has indicated it sees a role for them, as long as they are as accurate or sensitive as possible. The FDA standard is over 80%, and I think with that, what we're seeing with the antigen tests, that is not too high of a bar to achieve because several have achieved it. Admiral Brett Giroir, the administration's testing czar, told reporters, referring to the BD and Quidel machines, there are several more that are very low cost and would be in the range that are being considered.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, back to local news. We've had a significant breakthrough in our local response to our COVID-19 epidemic. The Lucas County Regional Board of Health has recommended that all schools in the county teach only remotely until at least October 1st. Here is their statement. Lucas County is experiencing significant COVID-19 spread within the community has been on alert level 3, red, under the Ohio Public Health Advisory System since July 17th. This level indicates very high exposure and community spread, and all in-person activity should be limited as much as possible. The Toledo-Lucas County Health Department has identified an increase of COVID-19 cases in those who are younger. Approximately 57% of all confirmed cases in July and into August are comprised of individuals under the age of 40. The Lucas County Regional Board of Health has made the following motion during today's special board meeting. The Board of Health, based on public health principles and the best public health information and analysis available to us, and consistent with our mission to promote and protect the health of all people who live, learn, work, and play in Lucas County, issue a recommendation to all boards of education and school boards in Lucas County that they implement remote education for their students beginning on the first day of the fall semester and to be presumptively in place until October 1st and to be reconsidered collaboratively in light of data and public health information which will be evaluated against criteria to be established by the Board of Health. And that further, we recommend that all interscholastic sports be presumptively suspended until October 1st likewise to be reconsidered collaboratively in light of data and public health to be evaluated against criteria established by the Board of Health. The Health Department will continue the conversations and collaboration with local school boards to ensure the safest decisions are made while protecting the health of students, teachers, and faculty. Okay, well, good for them, good for us. It is worth noting that the Board of Health does have the legal authority to make this recommendation a binding order, but they have chosen a less restrictive path. Fortunately, so far, schools' response to this recommendation have been positive. Of course, With 13,000 school districts around the nation, there are many different responses to school reopenings. Let's take a sampling. In a cautionary tale, How Not to Reopen Schools, this from the Palm Beach Post, Florida is at it again. Health directors told to keep quiet as Florida leaders press to reopen classrooms. It's not up to the health department to say a yes or a no, the governor said. As Governor Ron DeSantis pushed this summer for schools to reopen, state leaders told school boards they would need health department approval if they wanted to keep classrooms closed. Then they instructed health directors not to give it. Following a directive from DeSantis' administration, county health directors across Florida refused to give school boards advice about one of the most wrenching public health decisions in modern history, whether to reopen schools in a worsening pandemic. In county after county, the health director's refrain to school leaders was the same. Their role was to provide information, not recommendations. They could not tell school boards whether they believed the risks of opening campuses were too great, they said. They could only provide suggestions on how to reopen safely. For frustrated school board members, it was a puzzling turnabout. Florida's public schools have long depended on local health directors for recommendations on everything from reducing encephalitis risks at football games to how to test students during tuberculosis outbreaks. But the director's new reticence aligned perfectly with DeSantis' stated goal of pressuring Florida public schools to offer in-person classes. Lacking clear guidance from the local health directors, school board members in many counties said they felt compelled to reopen classrooms despite serious misgivings about exposing teachers and students to COVID-19. Keeping campuses closed, they said, risk violating an edict last month from State Education Commission Richard Corcoran, which decreed public schools, quote, must open brick-and-mortar schools at least 5 days per week. When we voted to reopen schools, I'll be honest and tell you I did it because we are under an executive order to do so, Mark Dodd, a school member in Lake County, said last week. Do I think they're safe? Absolutely not. Public schools across Florida will continue to let students learn from home if they choose, but many health experts worry opening classrooms will nonetheless cause COVID infections to spike. Corcoran's emergency order pointed to one way around the state's open campus mandate, a waiver from state or county health officials. The provision made school boards more dependent than ever on health directors' recommendations. But at the same time that Corcoran, a DeSantis appointee, was requiring health department approval to keep classrooms closed, health directors were told not to make a recommendation at all. The director's refusal to guide educators through the roiling school reopening debate stemmed directly from a directive by Surgeon General Dr. Scott Rivkees, DeSantis' appointee, to oversee the Department of Health and its county offices, the Palm Beach Post found. Health directors of Volusia and Brevard counties both said last month that they were instructed by state supervisors not to offer opinions on whether schools could safely open. In Volusia County, Health Director Patricia Boswell and Rivkees' office said Rivkees' office told her and her colleagues across Florida to instead limit their input on how to reopen campuses safely. We've been advising that our role here is to just advise as to what can we do to make the environment in schools as safe as possible with COVID-19, Boswell said during a school board meeting. It is not to make a decision on whether or not to open the school. Echoing those comments, Brevard Health Director Maria Stahl said health directors can't give direct advice because they, quote, have to follow the orders that we have. What I can say is DeSantis has ordered for the schools to be open, Stahl said. The education commissioner has ordered schools to be open, so all I can do is give them statistics. I don't think any of us are in a position to balk the governor, Stahl added. In Palm Beach County, Health Director Dr. Lena Alonzo told school district officials she, too, was instructed not to give formal recommendations about whether to reopen, the school board's chairman said. In a statement, Alonzo acknowledged she declined to provide a written recommendation after consulting with health department attorneys. She said her role was not to make reopening decisions, but to give accurate, up-to-date data to my community partners. State health officials acknowledged Rivkees instructed county directors to focus their advice to school boards on how to best reopen campuses. They did not dispute the director's account of being told not to opine on whether schools should remain online only. Rifkies advised all county health department administrators to engage with their local school districts to serve as a resource to the school districts on how to open schools in the safest manner, the department said in a statement to the Palm Beach Post. After this story was published online, DeSantis defended his administration's directive at a news conference in Orlando, saying he didn't want health directors in a position to overrule elected school boards. It's not up to health departments to say yes or no, the governor said. They inform the policymakers. They provide information, and they should absolutely do that. But to say they should be the ones that have effectively veto power, that's just not the way it works. It's an advisory role. The idea that health directors should not give school boards recommendations on such a weighty public health matter is an extraordinary shift, one that runs contrary to county health department's historic role, two former health directors said. Yes, we always advise them what to do. They call us every time there's an outbreak, Dr. Claude Darmarage, who served as Pinellas County Health Director from 2006 to 2015, said of the public schools. Schools are educators. They are not health experts. They have nowhere else to turn but us. Dr. Gene Malecki, Palm Beach County's health director from 1989 to 2009, said she routinely gave the school district recommendations about how to handle infectious disease threats, including pressing the district to ban evening football games during a 1997 encephalitis scare. State laws task county health departments with promotion of the public's health and control and eradication of preventable diseases, a responsibility that Malecki said should put them at the center of all local public health decisions. The health officer must have a say into when schools should open or reopen and should have active participation, Malecki said, whether the state puts pressure on you or not. You have to weigh the balance of what's best for the community. The refusal to give reopening guidance was not uniform across Florida. In some counties, health directors did urge school districts to keep classes online. When COVID cases started to surge last month in the Florida Keys, Monroe County's health director shut down summer school classes and recommended that schools remain closed for at least the first 4 weeks of the school year. The director and his second-in-command, who have been in office for decades, have a long collaborative history with the school district, school board member Sue Waltansky said. They are also toward the end of their careers, which she said may have insulated them from political pressure. I don't think they worry about losing their jobs, Waltansky said. In Palm Beach, Alonzo declined to give a formal recommendation, but did tell school district officials during a small advisory committee meeting that she believed the number of COVID cases were too high to reopen classes. Based in part on her recommendation, Palm Beach County School Board voted to keep campuses closed, but South Florida is still in phase one of DeSantis' reopening plan. They expect their online-only plan to be approved. But the dynamic has been different in other parts of Florida that have moved into the second phase of the state's reopening plan. DeSantis and Corcoran have given conflicting explanations of how much leeway school boards have to keep school classrooms closed without health department approval, arguing at some point that school boards have total autonomy to stay online only if they choose, and that schools must offer in-person classes at others. School leaders in many counties concluded the order left them little choice. In Leon County, where the county health director insisted her only role was to provide current data and to educate the school administration on how to provide a safe school environment, school board members pleaded last month for parents to keep their children home even as they moved to open campuses. Persons in high places have made a decision that makes it impossible for us to be flexible, school board member Daryl Jones said. Wickedness in high places, that's what this is. Although Corcoran's order explicitly empowered local departments of health to give reopening directives, Orange County's health director claimed it was not his place to weigh in. So the interesting thing about the orders is that I work for the Florida Department of Health, but I am not the Florida Department of Health, the director, Dr. Paul Pino, told the Orlando Sentinel. Orange County School Board member Pam Gould complained that we did not get a direct answer from Pino and the school district move ahead with reopening campuses. The county school districts later lamented in a national radio interview that the determination of when to open face-to-face was actually made at the state level. In Brevard County, where the health director last month claimed, it has never been our role to tell any municipality or any school or anything what to do, board members complained the lack of guidance placed them in a, quote, a really bad position. Our local Department of Health has been told they cannot advise us on the safety of reopening schools, school board chairwoman Misty Belford said, and our hands have been tied by the state's reopening order. Volusia County School Board member Ruben Colon reacted with alarm to Boswell's revelation that she'd been told not to opine on whether to reopen schools, saying it was, quote, unfair that the governor has put your office in a very uncomfortable position. I understand that you have been given this directive, he told Boswell. However, in not having advice of the Florida Department of Health, I personally do not believe the schools are safe to open. Even so, Volusia County School Board moved forward last month with plans to reopen campuses. Sarasota County is also planning to resume in-person classes, and there a health official did feel empowered this week to make a public recommendation. It was one likely to be pleasing to DeSantis's ears. Faced with new concerns from school board members about a lack of guidelines for reopening decisions, Michael Drennan, the health department's disease intervention services manager, urged them not to reconsider the decision to open up classrooms. Continue on with the existing plan, Drennan said. That would be our recommendation at this time. Okay, well, let's now switch gears and go to a state that has gotten a terrible pandemic under control much better than almost any other state, New York. This from The Hill. Cuomo says New York schools can reopen in person this fall. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced Friday that schools can reopen this fall, citing low infection rates that he said will allow students and teachers to return to classrooms safely. It is just great news, Cuomo told reporters. We are probably in the best situation in the country right now. When and how schools reopen will be left up to individual school districts. However, Cuomo warned that if the 7-day rolling average of tests coming back positive exceeds 9% in a particular region, schools in that area must close. New York's response to COVID-19 has been widely touted as one of the success stories of the pandemic. While the virus initially hit the state hard, especially in New York City, it was able to contain the virus with strict public health measures, including lockdowns, mask requirements, and a slow, phased reopening of businesses. The percent of tests coming back positive in New York is about 1%, one of the lowest levels in the country. So it's nice to get some good news, although I would have one major critique of this, is that currently there are around 1% positivity from the tests that they give out, and they do a lot of testing. I think the idea that you would not close schools until it exceeded 9% in a particular region is kind of crazy, I think. They basically consider if you have a positivity rate in testing of 5% or more that you have widespread community spread and that you're kind of on high alert. So to wait till get 9%, basically 9 times worse than what it is statewide in any given area before you would close the schools, seems a little bit kind of late and playing defense rather than offense. But hey, that's New York. Let's hope it goes well. Okay, well, let's take some time now to look at another issue that would complicate the reopening of schools and actually other large businesses. This from Stat News. Ventilation should be part of the conversation on school reopening. Why isn't it? Okay, and this was written by an epidemiologist who is also a medical student. Like every other parent with a school-age child, I want schools to reopen in the fall, including the one I'm attending. On the best of days, my son can be described as spirited. After 4 months of being cared for by his grandparents, he is practically feral. He needs the physical and social outlet that schools provide. And I need the anatomy lab to reopen because human dissection is an irreplaceable part of my medical education. But I am also an epidemiologist, and after reading the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's guidelines for school reopening and the various accompanying news coverage and think pieces, I can't convince myself that following its rules will keep my family, or yours, safe. Why? Because the primary way COVID-19 is transmitted is through respiratory droplets that careen through the air. And yet the capricious nature of air circulation and the lack of filtration systems in our already underfunded public school systems is absent from the conversation. Since New York State started reopening, I've received emails from my medical school's working group about the plan to bring us back to campus. Its plan is to follow the basic script seen in school reopening strategies all over the country. Frequently sanitize high-touch surfaces, 6-foot distances, unidirectional hallways, reduced capacity elevators in classrooms, health questionnaires, and contact-free temperature checks upon entry. More on that in a minute. My school is not negligent, but like many other educational institutions, its efforts are dangerously misdirected. We are collectively engaging in what Derek Thompson describes in The Atlantic as, quote, hygiene theater, in which organizations look to reopen focuses intensively on arduous decontamination strategies to mitigate surface transmission, even though that is not the primary route for COVID-19 transmission. And some scientists argue that there is no direct evidence the virus spreads this way at all. I'd also like to add temperature checks to the hygiene theater playbill, as they too fail to successfully screen potential COVID-19 carriers, but have somehow made their way into every screening list I've seen. Why is this happening? The CDC is supposed to determine the national priorities for American health. Of the 8 bullet points in its staff safety section, 4 address surface transmission. The 3 bullet points dedicated to respiratory droplets warn people to stay 6 feet away from each other, cough into their elbows, and wear a mask. The current CDC guidance about ventilation is as follows. Ensure ventilation systems operate properly and increase circulation of outdoor air as much as possible, for example, by opening windows and doors. But if opening windows or doors increases the risk of asthma or falling out the window, the guidelines go on to advise that they should be closed. That is all the guidance has to say. Does not mention air filtration or the fact that we have a pretty good data to suggest that without addressing air filtration and circulation, the 6-foot rule does not prevent transmission indoors. Here are the things that caught my attention as an epidemiologist as schools played Tetris with classroom furniture and agonized over hybrid schedules. On May 6, Aaron Bromage, a microbiologist at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth, published a widely read article detailing the role of air circulation at 3 major indoor transmission events, a call center in South Korea, a restaurant in Guangzhou, China, and the infamous choir practice in Washington State. Each of these events taught us that transmission happens when you spend significant time indoors. Being 50 feet apart with a low dose of the virus in the air over a sustained period was enough to cause infection, in some cases, death. This happens because infectious particles from individuals are pushed by the ventilation system to the other side of the room. Bromage's post appeared 127 days before the first day of school in New York City. HEPA filters are able to effectively capture particles the size of SARS-CoV-2, the COVID-19 virus. The CDC currently recommends their use for this purpose in hospitals, but their capacity to prevent the spread of COVID-19 in other public buildings remains underexplored. Though the CDC has stayed silent on the use of HEPA filters outside hospitals, on May 25th, a group of ENT doctors made the case for installing them in doctors' offices where aerosol-generating procedures are being performed because of evidence they can help prevent the spread of other infections such as SARS-CoV-1, measles, and influenza. That was published 108 days before the first day of school in New York City. On May 27th, a group of 36 scientists from all around the world in a variety of fields penned an article in the journal Environmental International entitled, "How Can Airborne Transmission of COVID-19 Indoors Be Minimized?" As they wrote, "Here, in the face of such uncertainty, we re-argue that the benefit of an effective ventilation system, possibly enhanced by particle filtration and air disinfection, for contributing to an overall reduction in the indoor airborne infection risk are obvious." It's obvious to me as well, and deserves to be our primary concern in reopening schools far more urgently than distance or Lysol. That was 106 days before the first day of school in New York City. McKinsey and Company reviewed research regarding airborne spread of SARS-CoV-2 and on July 9th posted an article suggesting possible upgrades to existing heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems, HVAC systems. A key recommended change was to increase the number of times HVAC systems exchange air per hour, which would push the infectious particles outside and prevent them from being blown across the room. This article appeared 63 days before the first day of school in New York City. When I mentioned these possibilities to a friend who teaches in the New York City school, she replied, quote, "Don't worry about our HVAC systems, they're all broken." Instead of using limited time and funding to engage in hygiene theater, we should be investigating how to address ventilation, or at the very least, be honest with the public about institutions' inability to make interior spaces safe. As a result of months of misapplied focus on surface disinfection, the importance of air circulation and the potential use of filtration is missing from the national debate on school reopening. My son's school and mine are both concerned with delivering our education safely. My son's preschool director was worried sick about not being able to adequately decontaminate on a daily basis because she loves both the kids and her schools. It shouldn't be her responsibility to research ventilation theory and filtration techniques and airflow patterns. It's not my job as a medical student to Google these things trying to get enough information to decide what to do about my son's school and mine starting imminently. It's not up to the administration at my school, who I know have been working around the clock these last few months, to figure this out. This is supposed to be done by the CDC. Here we are, about a month before public schools are supposed to begin, and the CDC is still failing to signal the crucial importance of addressing ventilation. We need to include air circulation patterns and filtration options in the conversation. If we are not willing or able to fund necessary upgrades to school ventilation systems, let's admit that. Until we have that public discussion, I am not comfortable exposing my family to schools. Because if I can't trust that the people making decisions are reading the literature, how can I trust them with my family's health? And speaking of trust, and for that matter, of partisanship, let's switch gears a little bit and do a couple stories on vaccines. Poll, this from upi.com. Poll, 35% of Americans, most Republicans, would reject COVID-19 vaccine. More than one-third of U.S. adults and a majority of Republicans would not receive a free government-approved COVID-19 vaccine if one was presently available, a Gallup survey showed. According to the poll, 35% of U.S. adults said they would not get the vaccine, compared to 65% who said they would. The share was the exact 65-35 split among both men and women. The age group that expressed the most skepticism about a vaccine were those between 50 and 64 years old, 59%. And the group that was most accepting of a vaccine were between 18 and 29 at 76%. By race, a survey found that two-thirds of white Americans and 59% of non-whites would take the vaccine, despite the viruses more heavily affecting the black and Latino communities. Such resistance is not unprecedented, Gallup wrote. When Gallup in 1954 asked U.S. adults who had heard or read about the then-new polio vaccine, "Would you like to take this new polio vaccine to keep people from getting polio yourself?" just 60% said they would, while 31% said they would not. So far, the willingness to adopt a new vaccine looks similar today. Leaders in favor of a vaccine may be well served to study what caused the public to ultimately adopt earlier vaccines as they consider how to best influence Americans to take advantage of such an option now. Politically, 81% of Democrats, 59% of Independents, and 47% of Republicans said that they would take the vaccine. Now, I like the historical data that they put in here to give us some precedent. And I think probably the best perspective that can be offered on this early polling on about vaccine hesitancy or willingness to take a vaccine is that we're talking about a hypothetical vaccine. We need to actually see what an actual vaccine is. And also the status of the epidemic. So you're asking, you know, hypothetical questions about hypothetical vaccines. And of course, people are going to be more hesitant at that point, trying to give a yes or no answer to multiple hypotheses at once. Okay, well, let's move to a story about another thing that could affect the effectiveness of a COVID-19 vaccine. This from CNN. U.S. obesity epidemic could undermine effectiveness of a COVID-19 vaccine. For a world crippled by the coronavirus, salvation hinges on a vaccine. But in the United States, where at least 4.6 million people have been infected and nearly 155,000 have died, the promise of that vaccine is hampered by a vexing epidemic that had long preceded COVID-19, obesity. Scientists know that vaccines engineered to protect the public from influenza, hepatitis B, tetanus, and rabies can be less effective in obese adults than in the general population, leaving them more vulnerable to infection and illness. There's little reason to believe, obesity researchers say, that COVID-19 vaccines will be any different. More than 107 million American adults are obese, and their ability to return safely to work, care for their families, and resume daily life could be curtailed if the coronavirus vaccine delivers weak immunity for them. Obesity has long been known to be a significant risk factor for death from cardiovascular disease and cancer, but scientists in the emerging field of immunometabolism are finding obesity also interferes with the body's immune response, putting obese people at greater risk of infection from pathogens such as influenza and the novel coronavirus. In the case of influenza, obesity has emerged as a factor, making it more difficult to vaccinate adults against infection. The question is whether that will hold true for COVID-19. Evidence that obese people have a blunted response to common vaccines was first observed in 1985 when obese hospital employees who received the hepatitis B vaccine showed a significant decline in protection 11 months later that was not observed in non-obese employees. The finding was replicated in a follow-up study that used longer needles to ensure the vaccine was injected into muscle and not fat. Researchers found similar problems with the hepatitis A vaccine, and other studies have found significant declines in antibody production induced by tetanus and rabies vaccines in obese people. Obesity is a serious global problem, and the suboptimal vaccine-induced immune responses observed in the obese population cannot be ignored, pleaded researchers from the Mayo Clinic's Vaccine Research Group in a 2015 study published in the journal Vaccine. Vaccines also are known to be less effective in older adults, which is why those 65 and older receive a supercharged annual influenza vaccine that contains far more flu virus antigens to help juice up their immune response. By contrast, the diminished protection of the obese population, both adults and children, has been largely ignored. I'm not entirely sure why vaccine efficacy in this population hasn't been more well reported, said Catherine Anderson, an assistant professor of biology at Fairfield University who studies obesity and metabolic diseases. It's a missed opportunity for greater public health intervention. In 2017, scientists at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, provided a critical clue about the limitations of the influenza vaccine. In a paper published in the International Journal of Obesity, researchers showed for the first time that vaccinated obese individuals were twice as likely to develop influenza or flu-like illness compared with adults of a healthy weight. Dr. Timothy Garvey, an endocrinologist and director of diabetes research at the University of Alabama, was among those who stressed that, despite the lingering questions, it's still safer for obese patients to get vaccinated than not. The influenza vaccine still works in patients with obesity, but just not as well, Garvey said. We still want them to get vaccinated. And I'll just note that this is really a double hit because the single factor that's most associated with COVID-19 morbidity and mortality is, in fact, obesity. So obesity could interfere both with the immunological response naturally and induced by vaccine, and if you get infected, the course of the disease. Okay, well, let's move on to our next story, and with a continuing coverage of inequities in health, well, this from Kaiser Health News, healthcare workers of color nearly twice as likely as whites to get COVID-19. Healthcare workers of color were more likely to care for patients with suspected or confirmed COVID-19, more likely to report using inadequate or reused protective gear, and nearly twice as likely as white colleagues to test positive for the coronavirus, a new study from Harvard Medical School researchers found. The study also showed that healthcare workers are at least three times more likely than the general public to report a positive COVID test, with risk rising for workers treating COVID patients. Dr. Andrew Chan, senior author and epidemiologist at Massachusetts General Hospital, said the study further highlights the problem of structural racism, this time reflected in the frontline roles and personal protective equipment provided to people of color. If you think to yourself, healthcare workers should be on equal footing in the workplace, our study really showed that's definitely not the case, said Chan, who is also a professor at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Fola May, a UCLA physician and researcher, said the study also reflects the fact that Black and Latino healthcare workers may live or visit family in minority communities that are hardest hit by the pandemic because so many work on the front lines of all industries. The study showed that healthcare workers of color were five times more likely than the general population to test positive for COVID-19. Their workplace experience also diverged from that of whites alone. The study found that workers of color were 20% more likely than white workers to care for suspected or confirmed positive COVID patients. The rate went up to 30% for Black workers specifically. Healthcare workers of color were also more likely to report inadequate or reused personal protective equipment at a rate 50% higher than that of white workers reporting. For Latinos, the rate was double that of white workers. All healthcare workers who reported inadequate or reused PPE saw higher risks of infection. Those with inadequate or reused gear who saw COVID patients were more than five times as likely to get the virus than workers with adequate PPE who did not see COVID patients. Chan said even healthcare workers reporting adequate PPE and seeing COVID patients were far more likely to get the virus than workers not seeing COVID patients, nearly five times as likely. That finding suggests a need for more training in putting on and taking off protective gear safely and additional research in how healthcare workers are getting sick. Okay, next up from Stat News, continuing our coverage on health inequities. Telemedicine is booming, but many people still face huge barriers to virtual care. As COVID-19 drives many patients away from in-person care and towards virtual visits, experts warn that the nation's most vulnerable members may be shut out of the booming telehealth business. Federal policymakers temporarily lax regulations to make it easier to provide virtual care during the pandemic, fueling a shift toward telemedicine that has become so popular among patients and providers that there are now a number of proposals to make the changes permanent. Just last week, President Trump signed an executive order that would permanently extend some of these policies. But a pair of new studies published this week show that there are barriers to virtual visits that regulatory changes alone can't fix. The temporary reform due to COVID allowed telemedicine visits from a patient's home, but it presumed that patients had access to the technology to engage in those visits, said Eric Roberts, a health policy researcher and at the University of Pittsburgh and a co-author of one of the papers. We're showing that there is a substantial number of Medicare beneficiaries who lack access to that technology. The paper, published in JAMA Internal Medicine, found that 1 in 4 Medicare beneficiaries were stranded on the far side of the digital divide in 2018, with neither a home computer with a high-speed internet connection or a smartphone with a wireless plan. That translates to 15 million people in the U.S. who, if they wanted to, wouldn't be equipped to make the leap from in-person to video visits. The study found that this technology gap disproportionately impacts people of color, low-income individuals, and senior citizens. Altogether, a very vulnerable population both in terms of their health profile and their economic profile. The technology itself has to also be accessible to the patients who need to use it. If your goal is really to get everyone connected, then you also need to handle issues about disability with vision and hearing impairment as well. That's not insubstantial. Kenneth Lamb, a geriatrician at the University of California, San Francisco, who co-authored another study also published in JAMA Internal Medicine on telehealth disparities in seniors on Medicare. The problem only grew more prevalent with age. A whopping 72% of people aged 85 and above were considered unready. Again, the study found that people of color and low-income individuals accounted for a disproportionate share of people who were considered unready. Lamb said the accessibility gap in telemedicine is unacceptable. When you think of building buildings, there are rules and regulations in place to make sure that they're accessible, he said. It's a responsibility of the person to make sure that there are ramps and elevators, especially if it's a medical facility. And my worry is that this rush to suddenly go to telemedicine, we have forgotten that there are still issues of accessibility when it comes to virtual clinics. Lamb said digital literacy programs and live captioning services for virtual visits could help make easier care for more people to access. And for many others, in-person visits will remain crucial. COVID has probably ushered in a new normal, where telemedicine is going to be an increasingly prominent component of healthcare delivery, Roberts said. This disparity is certainly not a problem that can be conquered overnight, but one that will require sustained and diligent efforts, given the likely sustained impact that COVID will have on how we deliver healthcare. Okay, well, I'm going to end the show with a completely non-COVID-19 related story. Woohoo! This from Science Daily. Experts urge evaluation of diet at routine checkups. The time has come for routine healthcare care visits to include some form of dietary assessment and counseling, according to a new scientific statement from the American Heart Association, published today in Circulation, Cardiovascular Quality and Outcomes, an American Heart Association journal. The statement, written by a group of nutrition and cardiovascular disease experts, recommends the adoption of a rapid diet screening tool that can be integrated into electronic health record platforms across all healthcare settings. Dietary patterns and quality are not sufficiently prioritized when addressing modifiable risk factors during regular healthcare office visits. Given the evidence that diet contributes to disease and mortality, it is a risk factor worth screening for continuously, said Maya Vividavilu, PhD, registered dietitian, chair of the statement writing group, and assistant professor of nutrition health at the College of Health Science at the University of Rhode Island in Kingston, Rhode Island. Poor diet quality has surpassed all other risk factors for death, accounting for 11 million deaths and about half of cardiovascular disease deaths globally, according to the 2017 Global Burden of Disease Study, a comprehensive report on the health impact of diet in 195 countries around the world. The statement authors reviewing 15 existing screening tools, assessing each to provide insight on the feasibility of incorporating an evidence-based dietary screening tool into routine practice. The authors list numerous reasons why members of a healthcare team may not address diet quality during a routine office visit. Lack of training and knowledge, lack of time and reimbursement, competing demands during the often short office visit, and that nutrition services aren't integrated into many healthcare settings. However, these barriers can be overcome. We want a valid, reliable way to assess diet that reflects the best science and meet the tools, and most of the tools assessed take under 10 minutes to use. Three of the tools assessed meet criteria set forth in a statement and may provide a framework to help practices incorporate diet screening into their workflow. The Powell and Greenberg screening tool asks two questions about fruit and vegetable consumption and sugary food and juice consumption. The rapid eating assessment for participants shortened assessment and the Mediterranean diet adherence screener ask more than 10 questions and cover major food groups as well as processed foods and alcohol consumption. The keys to an effective diet screening tool include using an evidence-based approach, assessing the total dietary pattern, not just a single food or nutrient, speed, the ability to give actionable next steps and support to patients, and the ability to track and monitor dietary change over time. There are other tools beyond what was assessed, and additional tools could be developed, said Vidivalu. While the statement does not endorse a specific screening tool, it encourages critical conversations among clinicians, individuals with diet lifestyle expertise, and specialists in information technology to adopt rapid diet screening tools for adults in primary care and relevant specialty care and prevention settings. An important component in addition to evaluating diet quality is targeting actionable changes, helping patients set achievable dietary goals, and then following up at the next visit. Areas for future study include testing and validating screener tools in diverse populations, as well as among special clinical populations, such as pediatrics and geriatrics, and evaluating the feasibility of implementing these tools in clinical settings. A healthy diet can improve cardiovascular disease risk and outcomes. What you eat and how much can affect other controllable risk factors, such as cholesterol, blood pressure, diabetes, and being overweight. I would also add, since this was published in a Heart Association journal, they focus on cardiovascular disease, but diet can profoundly influence cancer, the second leading cause of death, a very close second. Hopefully it'll remain second ahead of COVID-19 this year. Okay, well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. Or if you'd like to access this show to review it, or to queue up future shows, or listen to any past shows, go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.